This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to Unlikable Female Characters, the podcast featuring feminist thriller writers in conversation about female characters who don't give a damn if you like them. I'm Lane Fargo, and I'm here with Kristen LaBianca.
Hello.
And we are also joined today by Bethany C. Morrow. Bethany is an indie bestselling author who writes for adult and young adult audiences in genres ranging from speculative literary to contemporary fantasy to historical. She is the author of the novels Mem and A Song Below Water, as well as the editor-contributor to the young adult anthology Take the Mic. Her latest book, the social horror novel Cherish Farah, came out earlier this month. Welcome to the show, Bethany.
Thank you guys for having me.
This book is so fascinating. It's like nothing I've ever read. And I would love if you could just give a little summary of it for our listeners who might not have had a chance to pick up a copy yet.
So being thriller writers and readers, you, I'm sure, understand that I can give you an idea of the story you think you're reading.
Yes.
But not the story you're actually reading. So Cherish Farah is about, well, it's told from the perspective of Farah, who is a 17-year-old in biological age only. And she is one of two Black girls in this country club community. She is, however, the only one with Black parents because her best friend Cherish is a transracial adoptee who has been adopted from a very, very young age by the Whitmans, who are a white, very affluent couple who also happen to be very socially aware and very progressive and very intentional about raising a Black daughter. But being, as they are still, a white affluent couple, they have created in Cherish something like a void that Farah refers to as WGS, or white girl spoiled. They've given her this kind of life and privilege and arrested development that is usually only sort of seen in white children. And so because Cherish is a Black girl, it means that she really has no center. And because of who Farah is, she recognizes that as a void that she can uniquely fill. And someone who's really into sort of control and ownership it makes her and Cherish very, very close, troublingly close from a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's a great summary. I mean, I will say, and that's the great thing about books like this, but it's like, wherever you think this is going, you don't know.
Exactly.
You
just have right. to
you don't know. Yeah, wherever you think this is going, you're wrong. Uh-huh. I love that you described Farah as being who she is. Can you tell us a little bit about who exactly Farah is and what's her deal?
Farah is a budding psychopath. So, and I mean, like, literally, I think that when people refuse to accept that, it makes the rest of the story kind of confusing, because it sort of only makes sense if you understand exactly who she is. And there's actually a scene early on in the book where Cherish and Farah are eavesdropping on their mothers having a conversation on Brianne Whitman, who's the white mother, and Nicole Turner, which is Farah's mother. And Nicole Turner is trying to sort of confess a concern that she has about Farah. She's trying to, I don't even know if she's trying to warn Brianne so much as she's kind of just trying to talk about something that's troubling her with one of her closest friends. But what we see is that, and what Farah sees more importantly, is that Brianne is incapable of seeing her. She's incapable of like understanding what Nicole is describing. And it's usually because we have really we have like a pendulum of how we see Black girls. And on one side is the virulent, openly racist adultification of teenage Black girls, in which they're villains and they're fast and they're, you know, sexual and they're whatever. And on the other progressive side is their baby victims. And so either one of those is false. Either one of those is dehumanizing because it doesn't allow people to be real, multidimensional, fully fleshed out people with autonomy and motives and thoughts, just like you. So it might seem like, you know, this is like, oh, that's so great because she sees that they need to be taken care of. Well, yeah, but she doesn't see the person standing in front of her. So Farrah is exactly who she says she is. And there is a consequence to the anti-Blackness that leads to an inability to accept that.
I think psychopaths always make really fascinating narrators because, I mean, we're all unreliable narrators, right? Like whoever's narrating a book is unreliable.
Have you said that before? Do you believe, like, I'm sorry, you're the only other person on this entire tour who has said that, and they've constantly asked me, do you think she's unreliable? And I'm like, every narrator is.
Yeah. That seems obvious.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Obvious, right?
Yeah, because we're all like filtering through our own perspectives and our life experiences.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Lane, I just can't tell you how much it means to me. And if you told me that you got your bachelor's in sociology too, I'd be like, at least that goes to explain some of it, because I don't understand why that is a difficult concept for people to like just accept that you are literally like, my imagination wasn't developed in a vacuum and neither was yours. So the way that I write and the way that you read are impacted by your stuff. So nobody is reliable. There's a difference though between being sinister or not. That's to me what we have to know as readers, not if our narrator is unreliable, but if they're intentionally unreliable, if they're manipulative or malicious, that's different. But I'm sorry, I shouldn't be this shocked that you said exactly what I've been saying all morning, but
I was just a theater major, but I guess, I mean, theater.
Oh, okay. Where's the overlap too, though? Because there's the people study. There's, you know, there's the character interrogation and preparation and stuff that you do for, there are certain things that require you to be interrogative and to be introspective, but also be able to acknowledge and study other people and awareness of other people and why people do the things they do. So I still see the connection.
Okay. Yeah, I love a psychopathic narrator because my last book had sort of a sociopath narrator. She's a serial killer. And I think another thing readers don't get about that kind of narrator sometimes is part of being a psychopath or a sociopath is you have this like outsized view of like your own.
Yes.
Like you know what's going on and you're right. And so they'll be like, well, she's not as smart as she thinks she is. And I'm like, yes, exactly. Like
exactly. That's, right. That's the point.
That's the
yeah.
point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I saw that in Farrah because she is like, she thinks she knows what's going on in every situation and she understands all of the power dynamics and she's like in control. She's got it. And then throughout the book, you see how much that's not true. Like she certainly understands more than the average teenage girl would.
Oh, absolutely.
She's very intelligent, but like she's making a lot of assumptions based on the way her brain works. And that was very fascinating. Mm-hmm. A little trick you did in the narration. I love that.
Well, and there's also not just, you know, we see every interaction with her, and then we hear her interpret it. So something that I can't apologize, guys, because I did it on purpose. Okay, but something that I realize that readers are struggling with is the fact that it's like, wait, am I wrong? Is she? Okay, wait, I didn't see it that way. Like, is that, I'm like, well, you have to allow for somebody to be extremely cunning and extremely strategic and extremely intelligent and also have blind spots or also be wrong about something. You have to allow for them to be right, but you do have to allow for them to be wrong. And that puts a lot, you know what I think it is that a lot of readers are used to just sort of trusting and going along with the perspective character, the narrator, and you simply cannot, you do not get to turn your brain off with Farrah. You have to stay alert because you're gonna see what happened. She's gonna tell you what happened. And if there's a disparity or something, like, is that a you thing or is that a her thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something that's like, there's something disorienting about that that's like really compelling, because it's like you kind of feel like, am I insane? And like, you know, we're it's a social horror novel, and when you talk about things that are scary, like, what's scarier than wondering if you're going insane? Like,
well, yeah, and then the social horror aspect of it, of course, is like the it's the social context of the society in which we live, the social institutions and everything. And what I love about that as a genre is it does not allow for the reader to pretend to not understand things. The things that that our society teaches you to pretend you don't see or pretend you don't understand. If that were true, you wouldn't even you wouldn't get the book. Like, if that were true, you wouldn't even enjoy the book. So it's like the fact that you, if you enjoy it, it tells on you. Like, you're aware of the context at work here. You're aware of the institutions at play here.
Mm-hmm. I watched some of the YouTube videos that you did for your publisher. They sent those along with the like pitch for this, and they were really interesting. One thing I was wondering if we could touch on here was you were talking about horror as a collaboration between the writer and the reader. Could you, like, I don't know, talk a little bit about that? I just thought that was so fascinating.
Yeah, I was talking about it in terms of, when people tell me that something is disturbing, that anything I've written is disturbing, and they've been telling me this since Mim. And so I was telling you guys about my dearly beloved Amy Suter Clark. And one of the things that probably drives her nuts is the fact that she will tell me something is troubling, and I'm like, is it? And then like, other people will tell me something I've written is troubling, and I'm like, is it? Because I'm just like, are we sure that this is troubling? But the reason is because what troubles me in terms of like, oh, that's gross, like, or what bothers me, I should say, is like gore and body horror and stuff, because you're doing it on purpose. Like, you're showing me a full picture of something that is intended to be upsetting, is intended to look destructive and violent. And there's a laziness to it. That doesn't mean it's not well done ever, but there's a laziness to it because it doesn't require anything of me except to be a human and know what blood looks like. So I always shy away from that sort of thing. I love psychological stuff. I love psychological thrillers. And so it's a kind of troubling that I really love. So when somebody says that my stuff is troubling, I guess I don't know. It just doesn't register to me that way. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that part. But anyway, like my first novel, Mem, which is a speculative literary and has historical elements and stuff. And I remember certain things about the story, and then people would be like, well, you know, it was troubling as well. It had its troubling moments. And I'm like, it did? Like, that's, I don't know. Because the thing that I shy away from, that I don't really enjoy, I don't really watch a lot of horror because I don't like gore, because I don't like you just showing me explicitly in action a thing that I already know is upsetting. So the reason that I like social horror and psychological thrillers is because it strategically implants thoughts and concerns based on what it understands of you, the viewer, based on what it understands of the culture and the society that you are from and familiar with, right? And so instead of explicitly showing you something that's going to upset you in the moment, and then largely the impact, it's not something that people are going to talk about for weeks after they've seen it, right? Because it upset me in the moment because it was supposed to. You showed me something upsetting. Psychological thrillers tease something that already exists in your awareness, already exists in your mind, and leave space for you to fill in the blanks. And therefore is a collaborative effort. It's extremely personal to what about that context troubles you. And that also means that you cannot get away from it as easily because you're part of its construction. And it also, of course, is that in itself makes it so cunning and so sociologically clever, because you have to have a true awareness of the audience. You have to truly understand the culture that they're in and what they know, even the things they deny knowing. Social horror is sort of the pitch perfect genre because of that, because it's, you can deny in conversation awareness of something, or, oh, I just didn't know. I just had never been exposed to blah, blah, blah. I know how socialization works. So I know that can't be true. If I'm aware of it, and it's observable and it's a lived experience, I know you've seen it. Whether you wanted to acknowledge it or not, and whether you have a choice and a privilege to decide not to, is something else entirely. But I know you saw it. So social horror requires that you know this in order to experience it and in order to enjoy it. And like I said, it tells on the audience. And I absolutely love that because it is collaborative and it is very contextual.
Yeah, and it does stick with you longer because it's like, if it's something that's in your world, whether you
already,
like,
understood.
Yeah. And then when you see it again, it just sticks with you. It's going to, like, take you back to that experience of reading that book or watching that movie, or you can't avoid it. Yeah, totally.
I think that's really interesting because it, like, as a writer, that requires, like, having more respect for your audience and knowing that, like, in order for them to experience this fully, they can't just sit there and passively enjoy something. There are plenty of, you know, good horror movies and, you know, good horror novels, but the idea of, like, things that are gross or things that are, like, startling, that's not the same thing as things that are scary and things that like will trouble you and really stick with you. And I think that, like, there's a really important difference there. Like, if you want to just, like, sit there and be, like, thrilled and chilled and, ooh, I'm, you know, titillated for 90 minutes or whatever, like
a slasher.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But then if you want to, like, sort of dig deeper and, like, interrogate some of these social ideas, like, that's definitely much scarier than anything just like popping out of from behind a corner or something.
Well, because when you put this book down, that truth is still going to be true.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When you put this book down, that the horror is based in the society that you live in, that horror is real.
Yeah. It's not like, oh, thank goodness that's over. Like, I enjoyed. Yeah.
This is the world that you actually live in. Are some of the scenarios heightened or who knows? Because we don't know what everybody's doing.
Fair enough.
There's always that. We cannot be sure. But yeah, that's the thing, is that it's literally indicting, and it's telling on society, but it's also making it where you don't get to walk away from this now and go back to pretending you don't know.
Mm-hmm. And to go back to my theater background, it doesn't give you that catharsis like a slasher movie or something where like the killer is defeated. It's like it's just going to continue happening, even if like in Get Out, you know, Chris gets away at the end, but nothing that he's been dealing with, it, like, all of those people who are participating in that are still out there. All of the forces that led to it are still out there. Like, he individually got away, and, like, maybe just for now, like, he might still
face them. Just for now, because this is a network, right? The reason this is a horror is because it's based on white supremacy and this ability, first of all, to operate clandestinely. So the biggest horror of that sort of scenario is you don't know how many people are involved in this.
Yeah.
You don't know how many people are actively doing this. That's why there's no such thing as, like, closing the book and being like, okay, well, that story is over. Yes, but the world is intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good times.
I totally get what you're saying too about, like, people telling you your work is disturbing and being like, is it? I feel like we all, like, any of us who writes anything sort of crime adjacent or horror adjacent, we all have very broken.
It's terrible. And even when I say, like, I don't watch horror, and I don't, you know, it's like, oh, I've never been into horror. I think of what I did used to watch, and I also I should say I don't watch horror socially because I always watched it alone. This is, like, more troubling the more I think about this. So I don't know if you guys have ever heard of, okay, spiritual thrillers. I was always really big into, because I'm not, like, horribly afraid of humans, but there were, like, lost souls, fallen, Event Horizon, which I don't know how I've been going around saying I don't like horror all of these years, because I watched just a trailer for Event Horizon and remembered, like, what's actually in that movie. And I used to watch that movie, like, in high school at night when, if everybody was gone except for me, for some reason I would watch Event Horizon.
Just like your comfort movie. Event Horizon.
And then, like, Children Under the Stairs, Tales from the Hood, I not Candyman. I did not I did not watch that by myself because that would have just been ridiculous. But yeah, when I, so it's really strange because I guess I have to think about it in the way that I feel like people are typically talking about horror, which is like, oh, let's go do this fun thing. Let's go to the theater. And that's not, that to me is like, why do you like this? Like, what's going on? But if I think about like, I don't know how to categorize what I was using horror for. I just know that it was like, it was a very personal thing. That's troubling. Anyway, let's pretend I didn't say that stuff.
I tend to like to watch horror at home. I don't usually like to go see it in a theater. There's something about just knowing I'm in my own space or that I could turn it off if I want. I mean, I guess I could leave the theater if I was.
It feels too much space, I think. Like, and that's the way I only think that now, I think, because with the pandemic, I've adopted all these little idiosyncrasies, which is like, if I want to watch something and not have to pause it a million times, no matter what the genre, I have to like have headphones and watching it on the laptop. I have to like make it small. I have to like constrain it somehow. Mm. I can't just like have it out in the room taking up all of the space. I don't know how that makes sense, but that's like what's been happening. And I think about the times that I have gone to the theater to see things like, okay, Resident Evil, the first Resident Evil, which is Mila's fault because I was like, well, I have to try. and I didn't walk out, but I did turn totally toward the wall. And then The Cell.
Mm.
I tried to see that in the theater twice and I walked out twice.
Wow. Okay. Man, I haven't thought about that movie in forever.
And I've never finished it. And it's all, I always got to the same part. And it was, the troubling thing was the irrationality of calling out for her father, one of the victims, as she was like, the water kept raising, so she's drowning. And the irrationality of calling out for one of your parents when you know they're not there was so upsetting to me that I was like, no, I can't deal with this.
Okay, so we are having some technical difficulties and we have lost Kristen, so she may like pop back in like a jump scare in a horror movie at any moment. But until then, Bethany and I are just going to keep talking. So Bethany, I would love to ask you about, you write in so many different genres and categories, and I am just fascinated by this because I like do not have an imagination like that. I feel like I just keep writing the same book over and over. So like, where, how do you come up with these ideas? How do you decide like which, whether they're YA or adults or, yeah, just, I would love to hear about that.
Yeah. I always follow the concept and character. So I, before Cherish Fair, I'd never written technically a social horror. Before A Song Below Water, I'd never written contemporary fantasy. And I would have told you that I wrote speculative literary fiction because that's the majority, or science fiction, straight science fiction, because that's what I had always written before. But I am really, I know that I tend to have speculative concepts. And I found that a couple of things sort of function very much like speculative concepts to me. And that is, true historical fiction, or like in the case of Cherish Fair, something like social horror, because there's almost a dual world, a two world reality happening. There are multiple realities happening at one time in those stories as well. So in terms of whether something is adult or young adult, it really has to do with who my actual target audience is. It really doesn't have very much to do with the story. When I'm writing young adult, my target audience are teenagers. Mm-hmm. It's teenage Black girls. It doesn't matter who else reads YA. That is the actual target audience of YA. So
yeah.
my outlook and my care for the reader is completely different when I know that I am specifically writing to a Black teenage girl. Again, it doesn't matter who else is reading it. That's what causes me to take care with them and take care with the things that I choose to present, how I choose to present them. Now, obviously, because they're Black American girls, they are aware of certain things that are heavier and more destructive than other people. But I also don't intend to simply regurgitate that back at them. That doesn't serve any purpose except to traumatize. So I'm always trying to illumine something, give them language, and basically edify them just in their identity and as people, and I'll know that because the story inherently has some of that in it. With Cherish Farah, you have two 17-year-old girls, but it's really obvious that the target audience are not teenage girls. This is not sort of an edifying story. It's not meant to be like, I just want you to know you're seen. I mean, yeah, if you are a psychopathic teenage Black girl, I do see you, but I'm not trying to like encourage anything in particular. Which is the difference for me between adult and YA is with adult, I trust the reader, also because I don't buy their excuses. So, as we were talking about earlier, I expect the reader to show up with their brain turned on, and I treat them like they did that. And I'm less explicit, probably in my adult, even than my YA, but I'm very much aware that this is that my target audience is an adult reader, and that I trust that they can close a book. Mm-hmm. I don't take the same kind of care. It doesn't mean that I'm reckless, but I certainly don't take the same kind of care that I do with a young adult audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's really interesting. I think like never having written YA, like as an adult writer, you do just kind of, it's like you're entertaining or you're provoking or you're whatever, but you're not necessarily trying to, I mean, YA is certainly not about imparting lessons, but it's like more important to take care for your reader like that. And there's a lot more, right. Not rules exactly, but like guidelines to make sure that you're treating them.
Well, I don't know if those guidelines really exist, because I don't know if other writers even do it anywhere close to the same way that I do. But that to me, that for me is what matters to me, is what I'm doing, is making sure that I'm taking care with them. And especially because my target audience is, you know, the most disrespected demographic. And it matters to me that they are seen and acknowledged and validated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I meant guidelines, not in any official sense, but I've heard from my friends who write YA, like I'll talk about, for me, it's usually a queer character because I'm queer. Like I'll talk about a queer character doing something really bad. And if they're YA authors, they'll be like, well, that's like bad representation. And that's not. And I'm like, well, but it's adult. So it doesn't, like every one of my books are terrible. It's fine.
Right. You know, and we were talking, I think it was, I'm sorry, I've done so many interviews today. I hope this is where we were talking about it, but I think at some point I was talking about when you have a lack of representation and then everything sort of becomes a respectability politics, which isn't good because it means that these marginalized characters don't get to be real people, because it can't be messy. They have to be, you know, you have to serve a representation purpose, and that's not fair to us. But, and there's a reason, and it's and that's why I get so mad, not at creators, but at the industry, because the industry created this lack of representation and inclusion. That means that you are expecting me to write these very respectable and very one-dimensional characters, which in the long run, that might feed me today, but it's not nutritious. It's not something that actually, that I can be sustained by. It's a very short term. You've put us in this sort of like, at this deficit where we're only really able to satisfy today's needs, and we don't get to build in terms of the complexity and all of that. You know, the thing that really edifies the entirety of your personhood. And it gives the impression over a longer period of time to the reader that this is the right way, and that there is a right way to be a part of this identity. And that also is a problem. So it's a very short-sighted, you know, I know why it exists, but it's very short-sighted, and it's not to the benefit of that marginalized community.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting. Again, I can only speak to adult books and like as a queer person, but like to see how that has changed, because it used to be maybe there'd be like one or two queer characters at most in an adult thriller, and they'd be kind of like the best friend and not be very dimensional. Right. And now we're seeing protagonists. We're seeing people who are like really messy and fucked up, like thriller characters tend to be. And yeah, like that is, even though it's not like a positive portrayal, and I'm doing air quotes, you can't see on the podcast.
You can't see your air quotes.
but like, it's not a positive portrayal, but it's like showing you the full personhood and you know, yes. that queer people can be just as messy and fucked up as white women in the suburbs who think their husbands are trying to kill them.
Right. And that's the whole, you know, that's a huge part of what's happening in Cherish Farah. It's a huge part of her realizing that people have very, very stunted understandings of who Black girls can be. And she's taking advantage of that.
So what about your writing process? Does that kind of change depending on what sort of book you're writing, or do you have a standard process that you stick with for each book?
I do not have a standard process. And anytime I think I have a standard process, it means that's what I'm doing right now. And it will change and I will completely forget that I did it some other way. So no, every book, you know, I try to tell people, write the book the way that the book needs to be written. Yeah. Because for me, it's completely different. And I don't necessarily think it's because I write across genres. I think it's because it's a different book. It's a different story. And I will probably never be a full plotter because I don't understand the point of that. I'm like, if I'm going to write it, let me just write it. Like, why am I writing all of this information about these scenes? Why don't I just write the scene? So only because it feels redundant to me. Like, I don't enjoy that. But I do, you know, sort of, as Danielle Clayton says, the headlights plotting, where it's like, I know where I'm eventually going, or I hopefully wouldn't be driving the car. And I also can see what's right in front of me. So I will usually start, because I have a first line and I know what the first chapter is going to be. And it's usually a sort of an introductory chapter. It's usually, I say it's introducing the character, but anytime you're introducing the character, you're introducing the world as well. But I'll usually have that, and I'll know maybe what the climax is, I think, at the time, and what the ending is. And I don't know organically what happens in the first act. And so I will write, you know, I'll make a note about those few things that I know, and I'll write in what I think is the direction toward that. But part of what I love about writing is that organically, when I write, a bunch of other tensions are created and a bunch of other things are revealed. And I want that to always be true for me as a writer, so that's always true for the reader. Mm. So I don't want to try to know every single thing that's going to happen in a book before I write it, because I feel like that means it's part, and I'm only speaking for myself, obviously. I know a lot of people do the opposite of this to great success, but for me, it feels like a formula. Mm. And I can't get excited about that. So I can't write it.
Yeah. I am a plotter, but I have to admit a lot of the time it's procrastination, because I love to plot and I love to revise, but I hate to write.
I mean, drafting, once you get to a certain point, is pretty much the same as hell, I think. Yeah. And I feel confident in saying that. I always say, like, you know, if you've ever been pregnant, and I've only been pregnant once, but I feel like that's enough to be an expert. when you get to a certain point in the pregnancy and you're like, done.
And you've got like another month.
And you still have like a month and a half or something going. You're like, nope, done. I'm done. That's what happens to me with drafting. And it's equally as frustrating, because there's literally no fast way to finish it. You still have to literally write the thing. And it's the worst. It's the worst couple of weeks of my life, because I'm so done. And like, I know what I'm like, I'm done writing it. And they're like, no, because it has to actually all be on the page. And I'm like, but mentally I'm done writing it. And so I feel like it should just populate. And I don't appreciate the fact that I have to actually sit here and type these words. Like, it sounds irrational. And I wish that meant that it was going to make me like really take a hard look at myself and grow up. And it won't, because it's an emotional experience and it's so frustrating. I hate it so much. I just get to a point, and it's usually around like 65,000 words or something, where I'm just like, I'm done. I hate this. I don't want to do this ever again.
I totally feel you. That is how I feel as well. I just think it's so rude that like we have to write all the words. I don't know. I keep thinking I'm going to find a process at some point, like a couple books in, you know, you're very experienced. You've written many books, and you just like, you would think that at some point we could find a way to make it easier, but there's just no way to make it easier.
There is a book called Containment, which anybody who's ever heard me talk will be like, why are you pretending that this is the first time you've mentioned this book? But the point is, at the beginning of the book, the character, it's a science fiction novel by Christian Cantrell. And at the beginning of the novel, the protagonist, who lives on like a colony on Venus, like sets up his cerebral connection to his keyboard so that he can like lay down and like write all this stuff. And I was like, the thing that upsets me about science fiction is like, when are we going to start making the important stuff? Okay. Like, why does he get a cerebral connection to a keyboard where he just think writes, but I've got to actually like type all of this out, which that creates a longer process and time for you to forget what you were about to write because you were typing the last thing. Whereas if it was just like coming out as I was thinking it, I was just like, what, why has that not happened?
I just, if billionaires would stop like building dick-shaped rockets and going to space and they could like create these important things that we actually need, that would
create
be great.
Create the things we actually need. Create the cerebral keyboard, please. Like, truly.
That's fantastic. That's like all I want now. That's very similar to, I've always been very jealous of like in the Matrix when they can just upload skills to people's brains, but that sounds even better.
This is even better because I want the stuff in my brain out.
I think for all writers, it's very busy in there.
Yes, I need to get it out so that I don't have to go through that period of just like feeling congested and extremely pregnant at the end of drafting.
Yeah. Ugh. Maybe someday it'll get easier. No, it won't. Well, on that topic, what are you working on now, if you can tell us?
I am in the, it is all part of the writing process for me, but it's like I said, I don't go to the page until I have a first line. And that doesn't mean that once I write for that session, I won't be like, oh, that is part of the story, but it's not actually the first line. So it could happen multiple times.
Kristen's back, but we don't know for how much longer. The internet is being very strange today, and we don't know what's going on astrologically to cause this, but we will carry on. So what were we just talking about?
We were talking about what I'm working on, and I was saying I'm in the brain phase of my next project. So I know what I'm going to write. It's going to be a return to a speculative literary adult market, probably novella as my first novella, memoirs. I know the concepts, I know the characters, but I go through a process where it's like steeping. So that's where we're at right now. I have a couple of times been like, oh, I know the first line. And then it's like, that's good. That's useful. It's not the first line. So I'm not sure when I will actively be drafting that, but I'm assuming that I'm just going to like leave myself alone about it, at least until after this launch week is finished.
Seems like a good idea. Launch week is always just so stressful, even in this age of like electronic communication. I don't know. I kind of prefer the online launch. I know a lot of people disagree about that. Yeah.
No, I do. But it also means that people know that they can pack more into your schedule because you get to do it from the privacy of your home. And I'm like, is it really privacy of my home if you're all in it?
That is a great point.
That's a good point.
All right. Well, we will let you go. Could you just tell the listeners where they can find you on the internet?
Yes, you can find me bothering Amy Suter Clark on Twitter. and that is at BC Morrow, MORROW. And it's actually the same handle for Instagram, but I don't know what my relationship with Instagram is like. I don't know how I feel about it. Genuinely, I'm a word person and a conversation person, so just better on Twitter. And then I have a website, BethanyCMorrow.com, which is pretty much just a good place to see all my book covers and click them and figure out where to buy them from.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations on the launch of Cherish Farah. It is available wherever books are sold. And I hope you get a break and a snack now.
Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of Unlikable Female Characters. Don't forget to subscribe, and you can also follow us on Twitter at UnlikableFCPod for updates, book recommendations, and angry feminist rants. Our website is unlikablefemalecharacters.com, and we're also on Instagram at UnlikableFemaleCharacters. Thanks for listening.